Are you tired of selling kidney for a laptop? You need to take notes in your family WhatsApp group without your boss thinking you're not working? Tired of explaining something when you could just draw it and share it? How about that back end? Is it heavy laptop related? Let the Mesa Fundi come to your rescue. Hashtag freedom with Fundi. Attach Microsoft Office for the ultimate experience. Make the shift and upgrade to the Mesa Fundi with Windows 10 Professional. The Mesa Fundi, flexibility reimagined. Available online and in store at all leading retailers. Mesa recommends Windows 10 Professional.
What's going on? I can't travel to Durban and I really need to see the team. Our telephone bill is through the roof, our server crashed and we've lost all our files.
Are you getting frustrated with problems in your business? Win at work and calm the chaos with Vox's intelligent business solutions. Work smarter, not harder, and connect your business to the world from 899 Rand. T's and C's apply. Visit vox.co.za for more information.
I'm Duncan McLeod and this is Tech Central. This next discussion I've been looking forward to for a very long time. I'm very pleased to be joined now by Stafford Marcy, GM of WeWork in South Africa. Stafford is the founder of Thumbs Up as well, the company that developed the payment pedal. And he's also a former MD of Google South Africa, amongst many other roles that he's held over the years. Stafford, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you. How are you doing?
Yeah, lovely. Overdue, huh? It's been a while. Sorry that I've not been available as much as I've wanted to be, but I think there's lots for us to chat. So
I'm sure there's lots to chat. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Lovely. How are you surviving the lockdown? It's a pity we can't do this in person.
It's different. It's from a family perspective, we've had to make some big decisions, you know, taking kids out of traditional schooling systems and then putting them into online school. And just from a personal perspective, watching friends' businesses fall over. Mm-hmm. That's been very sad. People really, really struggling out there. And just watching some elements of the challenges that we have as South Africans with our leadership, right? I mean, just the whole e-commerce debate, we know we could probably jump into that one. I just wish that that was opened up, because I think if that layer was opened up, if e-commerce was truly a transversal layer that we all had access to and it was a possibility, I think it could do so much in terms of reimagining your business, whoever you may be.
Yeah.
So just watching that, and I'm trying to lean on, in my way, being on the board of the CSIR, I have a little bit of weight in some of the discussions. So I'm trying to lean in that direction. But, you know, I think inevitably we will do the right thing. I just hope it's sooner rather than later. So that's the one aspect. And the other aspect is it's lovely spending time with the family as much as I have. I've never been in lockdown with my kids for, you know, 40 something days. It's never happened.
49 days now, I think it is.
Yeah, so I have a 19-year-old, I have a 16-year-old, I have a 3.5-year-old. And yeah, it's been a privilege to just, you know, it's almost getting to know them better again, getting to know sides of them that I never discovered before. And just seeing what that does it's been amazing. I can see how households that don't have, you know, peace and harmony, how this could be really, really hard. I've just been blessed. We're a close family and we love it. I mean, my kids are saying they don't want lockdown to end.
Yeah,
they want to see their friends again, but they don't want the lifestyle to end. And that's been great to hear. And my wife, you know, Lisa, she's into fitness and all the online stuff. And just to watch her metamorphosize her business online. She does online classes now. She does online consults. You know, it's incredible how she's just metamorphosized her business. And I think a lot of businesses are going to have to go through that transformation right now. So the world is upside down. It's completely upside down.
How quickly do you think we're going to recover from this situation?
I love when people speak about this virus, because everyone's an epidemiologist, virologist, economist, all wrapped up into one, right? And look, from where I'm sitting, I'm privileged, because certain people that I get to be with at certain times through the board positions that I hold, both at Advitec and also at the CSIR, and some of the work that I do interfacing with government, does give me a bit of insight that's privileged. And I will say this, the way we think about this virus in a very sequential term, we think, okay, in September, the schools will open up and then this will happen, and next year, this will happen, et cetera. We need to understand that this virus is not well understood yet. I mean, I spoke to a very, very highly qualified virologist in our country over the weekend. And I gave him a call, and I said, look, what's going on? And where do you see this going? And he said, listen, people are talking about vaccinations. They got time frames associated with those vaccinations. We hear politicians speaking about it. But in all honesty, we don't even understand this virus yet. You know, what it does to certain demographics, what it does to certain age groups. We're seeing new symptoms in children, brain hemorrhages, strokes related to this virus. So this virus is still something that we're trying to figure out. Mm. Now, we're very confident as humanity, and thank God this is happening with the internet in its current state. Just imagine 10 years ago this happening. You know, no smartphones and a lot. It would be a lockdown would be a lot harder. Yeah. You know, we can't restart our businesses. We can communicate. We can do things like this, which is very, very different. Now, can we take the computing power and can we take all the coalescence of all the skill sets and coagulate all of that to come up with a vaccine quicker than we ever have in the history of mankind, which was the quickest ever was 5 years, you know, when the mumps virus was, a vaccination was developed. Can we? Probably. But let's just hope they figure out what this thing is and as quick as possible. My biggest worry is leadership, right? I think I've tweeted it out that what the world needs right now is not a vaccine as much as it needs leadership. I think even with a vaccine, I think the leadership that we see emerging on a global stage all the way through to a local stage is worrying. That's the worrying factor. And I think that may slow our progress. That may retard some of the, you know, some of the effects that we could have from a positive effect in the short term. But yeah, I'm positive, but I think this is a 18-month to 24-month cycle.
Yeah,
At minimum. And I think if you're not thinking that way as a business, if you're not operating, so if you're a startup out there listening to this podcast, so if you take one thing away from this, I can tell you now that this thing is not something that resolves itself in the next 9 months, perhaps not even the next 12 months. You know, you're looking at least an 18-month to 24-month window. Mm. You know, now work backwards. How are you going to rethink your business? How are you going to rethink yourself? What are you going to do with your personal career and how are you going to relearn? Those are challenges that we all face in our individual capacity, all the way through to your boards that are, you know, publicly owned and privately owned, thinking about this. I mean, it's a challenging time and it's very daunting to see what's happening around us.
Mm. Now, you mentioned your wife, Lisa. I saw her post a message the other day, I think it was on Twitter, saying that you have launched a podcast yourself, Stafford. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but
the idea behind it is simple, that I get to meet very influential people and I have the privilege of having them in my Rolodex. And every time I have a chat, like I said, I mentioned, I speak to a virologist, or I get to speak to Bruce Whitfield, or I get to speak to Jonathan Janssen, or I get to speak to Adrian Saville. You know, these people are not, the general public can't pick up the phone and speak to them. So I thought, let me do a recording of the conversations. Mm. So it's got no angle to it. It's got no purpose. It'll probably be 10 to 15 of these things. And it just shares expert information from people that are thought leaders and incredible minds. That's the objective. As simple as that. Nothing more, nothing less. Just giving them an opportunity to share with what I hear on phone calls from them with the broad public out there.
Well, I'm definitely going to subscribe to that, Stafford. What's it called and where does one find it?
It's Stafford Unplugged.
Stafford,
it's on all the, it's on Stitcher, it's on Apple, etc. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Great stuff. So let's talk about WeWork in the context of what's happening around the world now. How long have you been with WeWork now? It's probably about a year, is it?
Yeah, just under a year.
Just under a year.
I joined them September last year, yeah.
Okay. So you kindly gave myself and a few other journalists a tour of the WeWork facility in Rosebank a few months ago before this madness started, and a very impressive facility. But I imagine it's standing rather empty at the moment, given the lockdown. How has COVID affected WeWork's operations in South Africa over this time?
I think we've all been affected by it. I mean, when the lockdown came along, it wasn't a WeWork specific. It wasn't an industry specific. It wasn't industry specific. I mean, we all went into lockdown, right? 40 plus odd days ago, President stood up and said, everyone, you go home and irrespective of your business, if you're non-essential, I mean, that was lockdown stage 5 or lockdown 5 that forced us all to go home. Obviously, that empties out our buildings. And we kind of watched that. We thought it was going to be 2 weeks. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't 2 weeks. And then now we're in lockdown 4 and we're kind of understanding what lockdown 4 is. And as a business, we follow lockstep in that. Now, throughout the process, we didn't close our buildings.
Right.
In the beginning, we moved to what we call essential staffing. So some of our folks were in the building, but we rotated when they would be there. And we then moved to a complete eradication of our human resource in the building. So our community team. And our community team are folks that take care of the members. And it's kind of our, it's the thing that makes WeWork so special. It's that human being that you interact with when you walk into the building, the person that knows you, your birthday, you know, your the status of your company, the capital raise position that you're in, and all the value that we add relative to that. So those people we removed out of the building, and we had security guards there, but there were people that were essential services companies that could access the building, and you know, they were allowed to access it. The Wi-Fi was working, we were still cleaning it, and then we went all the way to a full lockdown. Mm-hmm. But the building was still available to folks that qualified and could get to it, and it was opened up. Where we are today, a couple of weeks ago, we've reintroduced our community team on the ground. So they are in the buildings, and you'll see a WeWork person there now, and we're starting to see people come back. So they're trickling back in. And what's very, very interesting is to watch this happen, right? We're seeing the hot desk and dedicated, the smaller SMBs, you know, they're coming back if they're allowed. Now, because technology is a sector that is allowed to operate under lockdown 4, we are seeing a lot of tech companies coming back.
Okay. Right?
But those are the 1 to 2 person, 3 person, 5 persons coming back. And that, from a social distancing perspective, that's quite easy. The bigger companies, that's the more interesting part, right? The bigger companies are contacting us, and we're starting to understand what their strategies are in terms of reintroducing their staff back in. But just to take a step back, what we've done in between our staff going into the building is something that we've declared publicly, and that's our position on COVID-19 and what we're doing relevant to it. So the building's changed tremendously. So when you walked into WeWork last year, I think, when
late
I did
last
that
year.
Late last year, yeah, it's changed. It's changed tremendously in terms of how we've augmented the space. So if you walk in there, you see clear demarcations on the floor relative to the social distancing that we're enforcing in the building. Our kitchen areas now have specific traffic flows that people have to obey. Floors have traffic flows. They don't have dual traffic flows anymore. Hand sanitizers everywhere. Folks get scanned, so there's thermal scanning or fever scanners as you enter the building. We're working in lockstep with our landlords in the buildings that we have relative to all of this. So the elevators, no more than 4 people are allowed in, and there's clear demarcations around where those 4 people need to stand. So it's a building that I would term hyper hygiene, right? Mm-hmm. It's a building where it's probably extremely safe to go into it because of the augments that we've made, number one. And I think one of the big augments too that I forgot to mention there is our HVAC system. So the air circulation in the building, we've done a lot of things with our building management system through to the filters and the amount of fresh air that we allow in. And that technology that we've always had employed, we've now augmented with greater capability around virus detection and general virology. So the environment is extremely sanitized. Obviously, it will never be 100% safe. But in my honest opinion, if you were going to have an office and you wanted to go to an office and work out of an office, I don't see a place more sanitized or clean than WeWork. I think it's an extremely safe place to go to. So yeah, working with our large members and understanding how they're going to trickle back, folks, it's very, very interesting to see. You know, WeWork gives me a very privileged position again to engage with so many enterprise, large businesses that do occupy our space. And these are, you know, Naspers and some of the names that the folks know. These are large businesses in our space. Not only our traditional business model and watching how that metamorphosizes business structure and how they see their business specifically, but through this pandemic, it's been quite interesting to see how they're going to come back and how they're going to schedule their workforces. So traditionally, let's say someone took 250 desks or 200 desks.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We don't see them coming back to them with 250 people. We see them coming back with maybe, you know, half that amount. So 80 to 100 people will come back. And so the space that they previously occupied, they can enforce social distancing in that space. And what we'll have is those people come on a Monday, the next tranche will come on a Tuesday, and there'll be times when they come to the building that's off-peak times, etc. So we're working very closely with large enterprises now as both in an advisory capacity, because obviously we have the space, but also in a capacity of just consulting with them around workforce orchestration relative to social distancing, etc. And we've had to do a lot of this investment. And WeWork's you know, our CEO declared publicly this week that we've invested tens of millions into enabling the space in this way. So WeWork is definitely a hyper hygiene space, and I think a lot of people find that attractive right now.
Mm-hmm. I was chatting to as the CEO of a large listed company a short while ago, and he was talking about he was saying that real estate companies are going to feel the pain of this COVID crisis way beyond the end of it. His suggestion was he now knows who can work from home, who needs to come into the office, and the suggestion. And it's not just him. I've seen reports of other companies looking in the same direction now, saying, "Well, do we actually need all of this real estate? Do we need to have all these offices around the country? We've proven now that people can work from home and do so effectively." What's your take on this? Do you think that the real estate industry is going to shrink? And by the same token, what's the impact going to be, do you think, down the line on WeWork?
I think the question's a great question, right? Because it leads to our industry and how we're going to have to metamorphosize. I think real estate will undergo a change. I think those changes are, you know, cyclical. I think the pandemic will affect it. But we hear people like Eric Schmidt coming out and saying that it's, you know, he's forecasting that people like Google and companies like that will need more space because they're going to need to enforce social distancing. So from a pure square meterage perspective, they're going to need more size. Mm. We also saw Jack Dorsey announcing last night / this morning that, you know, Twitter has announced that people can work from home forever now, you know, as a company. But if you look on the ground at what's happening with work from home, it's an interesting pendulum shift, right? We had companies like WeWork come along, et cetera, co-working spaces, people taking beautiful real estate themselves and densifying it incredibly. Then we see the pendulum now shifting all the way to people working from home. Yeah. But when I speak to CEOs in South Africa, and I've been doing this now quite extensively and engaging with them, what I'm discovering is that work from home will be a segment of their population, but definitely not the majority of their population. They accept that they can do business working from home now. They're like, I spoke to an insurance company CEO, very large, and one of the largest in South Africa. And he said to me that we never realized, we were actually worried. We thought we couldn't do this from home. Mm. And we're running a very effective business from home, and the productivity levels are going through the roof, et cetera. But here's the other side to that coin. Those leaders are hearing from the people working from home that their environments are not sustainable in the long run.
Right.
Number one is it's not always conducive to work from home, right? People's family setups, et cetera. So, you know, what percentage is that? It depends on the business. You've got to do that evaluation. Number two is the cost of supporting that is quite high. If you take a look at what businesses are realizing now is if everyone works from home, suddenly the CIO is getting calls from, you know, people saying, I can't access, I can't get to the server, or my mail is not working. And suddenly the CIO and his team are dealing with ISPs that they've never spoken to before, et cetera. So it becomes a very arcane, distributed, complicated environment very, very quickly. And there's a lot of cost associated with that, complexity associated with that. And then there's the security issues. We're not talking about the hacker with the hoodie getting into your laptop. We're talking about your 17-year-old watching his executive dad log on with the biometric authenticator, second factor authentication tool, and daddy goes to the loo and then he gets in there and he does stuff. And that seems to have gone through the roof too. So the cost, the complexity, the environmental readiness for something like that is to be debated. Now, I do think a proportion of the workforce will inevitably decide that this is how they want to work. Will this broadly be the workforce? I don't believe so. And I'm hearing this from CEOs. Now, what they're saying is the broad population is saying, we don't want to go back to that office that you provided us before. So we don't want to go back to the big building that you gave us with our logo in the sky. And I think that's where WeWork comes in. Mm-hmm. So WeWork says, okay, you know, you don't want to go to this big office in the sky and sit with everyone propped up there. Sure. You don't want to work from home either. WeWork will offer you a hyper hygienic environment with social distancing enforced, with connectivity given to you as a service, and space overall given to you as a service. So it's very attractive to an enterprise to say, hey, maybe we should just get all our staff WeWork cards. And wherever they are, they can walk into a WeWork. And this could work in a city. So the city becomes a campus as much as it can work on a global scale where they can walk into a WeWork. Because WeWork, you can hold accountable from a sanitization perspective relative to our standards and policies. Mm-hmm. Number one. Number two is the complexity is gone. Because when you remember the value of walking into a WeWork, right? When you walk into a WeWork and you authenticate, you can go to a WeWork in Singapore that afternoon, and when you walk in, you disconnect. That layer of identity federation that we have employed inside of the business is quite profound. I've never seen this in any other business. And I think that has a huge value proposition and allows WeWork to suddenly stand up with a silver lining through all this noise and offer a product category, an offering that is resonating. So, you know, is this just a posit? Is this just an idea? No. You know what? Over the last 2.5 weeks, Duncan, the amount of people that I've been speaking to that are not WeWork customers that are coming to WeWork right now saying, okay, we realize we've done this work from home experiment. We've got the infrastructure from a technology perspective for remote access employed. But we know that in the long run, a broad majority of our population won't want to do it this way. So can you help us? So we are engaging from a thought leadership perspective. We're engaging on a consultative perspective. And we're very excited to see our pipeline of opportunities relative to that. Because businesses that are very large are looking to move a lot of their population into a WeWork product offering that offers them, you know, the city as a campus, to walk in wherever they are, to have a professional setting, not distracted by kids. The connectivity works well. The amenities are there. They at least can see other human beings. Yeah. They can do meetings in beautiful offices, but they don't have to catch 3 buses and a taxi and be exposed to all of that to finally get to head offices. And so this has been very interesting. I didn't think this would happen. I had the same concerns when lockdown happened around how this is going to evolve. But WeWork's done a great job of metamorphosizing its model relative to this and its offering relative to this. And I think the bare benefit right now, outside of all this pandemic stuff, is co-working offers a flexible lease. And on a pure monetary level, a flexible lease is a value proposition right now to any business. You know, if you're stuck right now on a 15 to 20 year commitment, perhaps a 25 year commitment, you've paid your tenant installation, the landlord's overseeing all of that, you're stuck. And that's an enormous liability on your balance sheet right now. And if it's so suddenly flex co-working space becomes a great value proposition, because again, you don't know if your workforce is going to be 100 people next year or 80 or 20. You know, WeWork offers as a base value proposition the ability for you to flex your commitment. And that's very, very attractive. So on a pure monetary basis, it makes a lot of sense, all the way through to it being a product offering now that's very attractive.
I was going to ask about that specifically, because we've seen the newspaper reports about big retailers having very uncomfortable conversations with their landlords in the big shopping centers. There's been a lot around Dis-Chem recently, for example. And I was going to ask whether some of the people who lease space in WeWork's facilities are having similar conversations with you.
We're having those conversations. We're absolutely having those conversations. Mm. Businesses are distressed. Mm. They want to know what their options are. And one of the things that we have done for our members that have asked us, the smaller, especially the smaller businesses, you know, the larger businesses are not necessarily distressed right now. They've got cash flows. They've got cash reserves. So, you know, we're talking about the startups, we're talking about the smaller businesses. And what we've done is we've offered some form of rent relief. Mm. And that is just a deferment of the commitment. So instead of, you know, paying your rent over the last couple of months, we defer that and we just move it further down the line. So essentially, we give you a couple of months of breathing room, a month or two of breathing room. And that has been accepted very, very positively. But a lot of the discussions are hard. There are a lot of angry people, you know, a lot of people that feel they should be getting something for free. They feel that this wasn't their fault. They feel that the government did this to them and et cetera. But, you know, we all have commitments. We're all in a difficult situation. And a lot of the emotion that we hear, you know, it's very, very sad, because those businesses are not necessarily, it won't be the fault of WeWork. It's the fact that their businesses are actually dying.
Yeah,
and we've got to realize that they're in the situation. So it's been hard on my team, because some of those discussions are very emotional. Mm-hmm. Those discussions require a lot of empathy. But at the end of the day, we are a business and we've got obligations. We've got to pay our landlords that own our buildings. But I feel the measures in place that we've put in place are fair. Mm. We're trying our best to introduce some of these businesses that we think are very promising businesses that have a future to some investors that we think they should consider. So I have been introducing some of those folks on an ad hoc basis that we know. And that's, again, that's what WeWork does, right? WeWork doesn't just offer you space. It's all those other things. And we're trying to employ some of those things even in this dispensation. But it's very difficult. I mean, it's very hard to see what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So how many facilities do you have? You've got one in Rosebank, one in Sandton, and one in Cape Town. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, in the first 9 months, we've opened up a presence in, I think, the three core nodes in South Africa. Yeah. Cape Town, 80 Strand, 155 West in Sandton, and then 173 Oxford in Rosebank. Yeah.
Okay. And your expansion plans, are you going to open more facilities around the country? Has COVID slowed down any of that ambition?
No, look, our chairperson, Marcelo Flores, said, he came out and said very clearly that the way expansion can happen in a very smart way. You know, expansion doesn't necessarily mean we're just going to go around and sign massive leases and buy buildings and construct things, right? We'll look at things like franchises. We'll look at things like asset light oriented deals. Look, our focus right now is to fill the buildings that we have. We've done such a good job at the Link, right? When the Link is an incredible story. You know, 2,500 odd desks. We filled that up in 7 weeks.
The Link is your Rosebank one.
The Link in Rosebank. Yeah. I mean, we opened that one. We announced that one July, August last year. We opened up the doors early September. We filled up that building in 7 weeks from a subscription perspective. That is the fastest subscription of space in the history of commercial real estate in South Africa. It's never happened that quick before. We found the pent-up demand for the product offering was significant. Great for us to see that. And then we launched another two buildings. We did 80 Strand in Cape Town, and then we went off and we did 155 West. Those buildings being prescribed as per our forecast, and our focus right now is to get those buildings filled. That's the priority of the business at the moment.
Okay. But do you see opportunities in other cities down the line, like Durban, for example?
Look, we see opportunities throughout the corridors in Africa, right? I mean, if you take a look at Durban, is obviously a node that makes a lot of sense where business gets done. We've got a lot of people telecommunicating between there and there. We've got a lot of people coming to us saying, can you open up more presences, right? Can you open up in Pretoria? Can you open up in Waterfall? Can you open up in Four Ways? Can you do something in Nickel Way? Can you do something on the East Strand? Can you do something in the airports? You know, we've got members coming to us that say, can you open up something in Lagos, please? Can you do something in Accra? Can you do something in Nairobi? Can you do something in Mauritius? The demand is significant. Has the pandemic had an effect in terms of the progress relative to our thinking in that regard? Obviously, you know, the majority of my focus as GM in this territory is just to fill up those next two buildings.
Yeah, yeah. What type of companies does WeWork attract typically? Is it across the board, or is there a certain industry or industries that are attracted to a WeWork type proposition?
I think it's attractive to everyone. There are segments, obviously tech. You know, we do a lot of things for Amazon, for Facebook on a global basis now, providing them space as a service. HSBC, well documented, they moved into the largest WeWork in the world, which is 10 York in London. So banks, financial services industries, technology companies, all the way through to startups. People always think that we are startup business majority based. It's actually not. You know, if you take a look at on a global basis, 43% of our base of members are enterprise people. You know, these are large businesses that occupy thousands and thousands of desks with us in multiple locations. And they love the city as a campus or region as a campus value proposition with all the amenities that go with it. And obviously the value proposition is quite obvious, right?
Yeah.
A flexible lease with all the amenities that go with it. I think this is the way real estate will move ahead. Now, in South Africa specifically, a large majority of the folks that occupy our space are the larger enterprises. You know, we've spoken about some of those folks. You heard Naspers is in our space. We've got, you know, folks like Platform 45, which we've mentioned publicly before. A lot of tech companies, a lot of financial services companies in our space. And it seems to be a place where people go that are very, very innovative because the space lends itself to the millennial. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the big challenge right now that CEOs have out there. And WeWork steps up and really addresses this. You know, a lot of CEOs have a challenge around how do I employ, satisfy, and retain the millennial worker? Because the millennial worker doesn't really care about money so much. They care about impact and purpose. And WeWork's been able to create an environment that addresses that particular demographic really, really well. So if you take a look at the large corporations that are, you know, looking to do innovation. So a lot of people don't really move the entire business into WeWork.
Yeah.
A lot of people move their innovation teams into WeWork because of this, because they can employ, if you are in a WeWork, it's much more probable that a millennial is going to work for you, because they look at the work environment and they look at what happens inside of a WeWork, right? Mm. All our impact, our LGBTQIT stuff, the fact that the company's got the meat-free policy, the stuff that we don't just offer free coffee with a barista. We offer free coffee with a barista with a black female that's disabled, i.e. she's deaf. So it's not just free coffee that's amazing. It's free coffee with impact. Mm. And millennials love this. And this is going to be in the majority of the workforce in the next 10 years. I mean, the estimates are that 60%+ of the workforce will be millennials. So if you're a large corporation or if you're a medium-sized startup and you want to attract talent, it makes absolute sense taking up space inside of a WeWork within this notion. And also, if you're looking to attract talent on a global basis, you know, WeWork has over 700,000 members. And we have the WeWork mobile application that allows all those members to connect with each other. Mm. And the statistic inside the company that more than 60% of our members on a global scale do business with each other. So if you're looking for talent, to find them, you can find them within our, what I would argue is the largest physical social network on the planet today, in terms of our points of presence around the world. So you can find people that way. And also you can employ people on a global basis. You know, you can hire a guy in Singapore, a girl in Sydney, someone in New York, someone in London, and they could have disparate skill sets, and all they need is a WeWork card, and they can walk in and be part of your business and connect and operate. I mean, that's an immense value proposition.
It must be an interesting dynamic, though, having, as you mentioned, having large corporate clients like NASPASH, for example, in your space, as well as startup enterprises, because there's naturally going to be discussion between and information flow and idea flow between those corporates and the startups, and potentially down the line, deals will result from it, acquisitions.
Well, absolutely, we're seeing it, right? So example, I'll never forget the example that I mentioned to you folks. It was one of the first experiences that I had seeing this particular notion personified. A guy tattoos, he's sitting in the open community area at the link in Rosebank.
Yeah.
He taps me on my shoulder and he says, "You're the GM of WeWork, are you staff?" And I go, "Yeah." He says, "Sit down." He shows me on his laptop an invoice for 18,000 and something rand. Mm-hmm. And I go, "Well, what's this about?" And he says, his invoice, he laughs, says, "No, don't worry, it's not for you. I just want to show you that this company, XYZ in your space, asked, is there a graphic designer in the building?" Which is a large enterprise customer, right? I replied, "Yes." I ran up, I did 2 days of work for them, and I'm billing them 18,000 rand for that. Mm-hmm. You know, we see members moving into our space, two-man shops, you know, three people teams, and they are actually operating their businesses inside of WeWork, but they're making money inside of WeWork too. Mm-hmm. They're actually generating revenue from engaging with other members. And that's the magic, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we're constantly trying to cultivate in the WeWork space. And that's why there's some statistics around, you have such a higher probability, of survivability when you're inside of a WeWork versus outside of a WeWork. It's just simply because of all the things that we do and offer you inside of it. And, you know, when you're inside of WeWork, you actually see the magic happens. And that's why I wanted to be part of WeWork myself. A lot of people say, "Why did you join WeWork, right? You did the Google thing, you did the startup thing. It was quite surprising to see you inside of WeWork." It's because when I went to London, I actually saw this magic in person. And I wanted to personify that. I wanted to see African innovation, you know, executed on top of this WeWork platform and given a global stage. And that's what the mission statement, and that's the intent personally. And that's why I joined WeWork.
Great, Stafford. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other projects you're involved in. But before we leave WeWork, I'm just curious, and I know I've asked this question before, but I think a lot of people will be interested. Why a meat-free policy?
the origin of that was I think Adam Newman, the founder, and his wife. I think it was their lifestyle. And again, why? I think it's in the same context as our refugee program. It's in the same context as what we're doing right now as we work with helping the NHS and all the essential workers in our space and offering our space out to them. right? Offering out our barista services out to hospitals and nurses and allowing them to come into our space, giving them food, and helping in that regard. I think it's that mantra that's part of the culture of WeWork. And it definitely pervades pretty much everything that we do. So it's a fascinating company because everything that it does, it always asks itself, what's the purpose? Mm-hmm. And what's the broader impact associated with it? Like, example, coffee. Okay, we're going to give great coffee, right? You're going to walk in, you're going to get free coffee, you're going to get beer, you're going to get all those amenities. But the coffee one is one that I love because, excuse the pun, we did the partnership with I Love Coffee, mm-hmm. a Cape Town-based organization. And their purpose is to train up Black females as barristers. And we just love that. And that's how the partnership formulated. So it's not just coffee that's free and beautiful and nice, but it's actually got that broader impact. And again, that resonates with millennials. Meat free resonates with millennials. And people, it's an education thing. And it's, from a broader, it's just understanding your impact and your purpose as a business and, and as an individual on a broader, more philosophical basis. Is also the intent.
Yeah.
Self-awareness.
Stafford, you mentioned the CSR and Advertech, but you've had a number of ventures over the years. The most recent one, of course, was your entrepreneurial startup, Thumbs Up, which developed the payment Pebble. Are you still involved with that?
Yeah, I'm a shareholder. Mm-hmm. Not active in the business. I had to jump out because I was just absolutely burnt out. And we went off and hired a great CEO to mm-hmm. run it as a business. And they've been doing well. If you took a look at when you go to macro,
I
don't know if you've seen the little device, if you've got 10 items or less, I don't know if it's 20 items or less or 10 items or less. When you go to macro, you don't have to stand in the line behind the guy that's bought 3 trolleys worth of things for a spaza shop. So if you look at that, they have little inside the macro space, there's a little tent or double tents, and you go underneath there and there's someone standing there with the payment blade. And that's the technology that we invented at Thumbs Up. We also, South Africans can go and see in Mr. Price, the people that Q-bust you. So if you've got a few set of items, they'll walk up to you and say, hey, I'll check you out. Mm. And the device that they take out, they scan the labels and they take your card, either tap or dip it, and you put your PIN in. That's us. And when you go to Australia, you'll see ANZ employs it over there. If you go to Southeast Asia, there's some banks that do it over there too. South African made, South African invented, manufacturing facility is in Randburg. And the team are still doing some great things. I mean, I think Debonair's famous brands. If you mm-hmm. order pizza, it's integrated with that. Yeah. So it started off with the little payment Pebble. I invented that with the team. And then we built our own phone. Yes. And that became the payment blade. And that's been an amazing success story. Mm-hmm. And it has, it's had global impact. That's a product that we ship from here globally, which is a great innovation story for South Africa. And again, it's my way of telling South African innovators that don't think that you need to leave the country soon as you invent something and go to the States or go to Europe for it to be successful. I mean, stay mm-hmm. here. Stay mm-hmm. here. It's hard here. But that's why you stay here. I mean, it was very difficult when we built the little payment Pebble, right? Literacy was an issue. Energy was an issue. Price sensitivity was an issue. Security was an issue. If we had left South Africa, we would have not had those hurdles that we would have had to overcome. And we did here. And because we overcame those hurdles, we could go to Australia. And it was very easy for us to kind of deploy and implement over there. But we did many world firsts. It was an incredible team. Just mm-hmm. an incredible team. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did 20 MBAs while I was there.
Yeah. Great. And you're also at the CSIR. Are you on the board of the CSIR? Work are you doing there?
Yeah, I'm a non-exec. I sit on some of the subcommittees. And the minister approached me, I think last year. Sorry, COVID makes you lose time.
It does. I can never remember. I say to my wife, what do you mean it's Saturday today? You mean I don't have to work today?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was last year the minister approached me at the time, the Minister of Science and Technology, mm-hmm. and they wanted to refresh the board. And what they wanted at the CSIR was some folks that had private sector experience with some technology background to help the organization. And what I've discovered being at the CSIR has just been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It is the most unsung story in the South African government. I guess there's other things that the South African government's doing, but in terms of the innovation, the invention, the scientific discovery, and the human beings that that run that place and work in that place, the researchers, the CEO Tulani, Rachel that oversees all the research, just incredible, incredible human beings, probably the most unsung story. So part of it there is to take a look at the strategy, see what they're doing, but they need very little help in terms of the kaleidoscope or the portfolio of inventions and innovations that they've got to lean into. I mean, they're doing it from drones all the way through to missile detection systems down to, e-health through to, you see the command center that's front and center in terms of the COVID crisis right now. I mean, the CSIR has developed that. It is an advisor in the presidential's war room for COVID-19. There's a lot happening over there. The folks are inventing things that what I want to do is actually get Rachel on my podcast to talk about some of the inventions, because it's just incredible. They've started to work on a spray. Just listen to this. A spray that's an aerosol-based chemical that when you spray it on PPE, so on your coat, on your gloves, etc., it gives it a much greater antiviral capability. Right? So when the virus does splatter onto it, you get exposed to it, it actually kills it in a very short amount of time. They've invented this aerosol applicant to, private protection equipment. Wow. And that's a world first. They've done, they're working on a detector where you breathe into it and it detects whether you've got COVID or not. Mm-hmm. A breathalyzer for COVID-19. And they're testing this and playing. Incredible inventions. No one in the world has it. And we're working on that right now. And we are globally being consulted by the World Health Organization, the United States, and Europe relative to these inventions. And and it's exciting. So as much as it is exciting, the objective that's primary right now is ensuring that we can create a revenue model in partnership with the private sector that makes it a sustainable business, not a government-funded business only. And, some of these things go on to become quite successful. So what I've tried to do there in my capacity as a non-exec is work very closely with the newly developed business development team and introducing them to venture capitalists, introducing them to the startup environments, introducing them to some of the larger corporations, because a lot of that technology can augment a lot of what people are doing out there. And again, if I encourage people to take a look at the CSIR website and maybe ping me if you want to gain access to some of those people and just listen to what they're doing, because it is quite extraordinary. And again, they're an amazing vehicle for public research. You know, should we do this? What's the impact on this on a municipal basis for X, Y, and Z? They understand demographical data more than anyone. Great data scientists in that environment. So it has been an incredible place. I have never seen anything as prolific and saturated with human capability, technology, etc., as I've seen in the CSIR. And that's the objective there. It's just to help them from a strategy perspective and try to take some of that and make it a commercial success. And it gives me an opportunity to engage within the broader public sector leadership realm, right?
Yeah.
As much as I get to see over the shoulders of folks like Professor Tokozana, I mean, he's the chairperson of the board. Mm-hmm. He got the Medal of Freedom from the president a few months ago. He's an incredible inventor himself. He's the head at Wits University. Just to look over his shoulders, to be a part of some of those conversations and to influence those conversations in my little way is me giving back. And I think if you take a look at what our leadership is up to and what they're thinking, we always tend to tweet out that we don't like what they're doing. We tend to say, hey, here's a blog poster on how dumb they are, or we get together on podcasts and we say bad things about them. The CSIR, me participating in that, as much as it fascinates me, it's kind of my way of giving back. I mean, there's no real monetary gain being on that board. Mm. It's my opportunity to lean in and share some views that are alternate and to educate and cross-pollinate so leadership does understand some of the things that they should understand. Because I think as ICT, as a community in South Africa, we've not done a great job coalescing and coagulating our views and articulating that clearly to our leadership. I mean, the folks that lead us are folks that were in struggles. They were, ex-military people, freedom fighters, etc. So expecting these people just to understand the value of technology and I mean, just the e-commerce rationale right now, right? So the absurdity of that. That is a reflection of a lack of something, but I think it's partially our fault. I think if we could, in a more coherent and an articulated way, engage them, not on Twitter, etc., in a more meaningful way, we could lean into that. And you can hear just before COVID and lockdown, I mean, the president was speaking a lot about 4IR. Mm. And it wasn't just lip service. I mean, 4IR is a very real thing in the South African government. The fact that they're buying into technology being such an asset, and they're seeing the political capital in that. It's death by a thousand wounds with them, right? You've got to influence them in little ways. And that, me being on the board of the CSIR, allows me to kind of lean against that. So when they say something silly, I can say something back in the room. And hopefully that has a little bit of an impact. And I encourage other people out there, and I have been, certain individuals that have had some success in our particular field, to join some of these boards, some of these advisory councils, all the way down to a premier level in a province. You know, the premier of Gauteng, put yourself out there, put your resume out there, join the cause. They're open to that, as much as they've been open to having me on the CSIR. So yeah, it's my little way of giving back.
Excellent, Stafford. I think we'll leave it there. It's always good to see you and always good to chat to you. Yeah. Stafford Marcy is GM of WeWork South Africa, and as you've heard, he wears many other hats as well. And don't forget to go and listen to Stafford's podcast. What's it called again? Stafford's Guest. Stafford's.
It's Stafford Unplugged.
Stafford Unplugged. I'm going to go and subscribe to it right now.
Thanks so much, Duncan. I appreciate it, man.
Take care, man.
Okay, cheers. Ciao, ciao. Bye bye.